From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the Deep South on a girl's 10th birthday. The girl's name was Tina, and on the outside, her family had everything. She had been born in a small Mississippi town, and it looked like a life of abundance, as she writes in her memoir, Southern Discomfort. Her family had the only swimming pool in her town. Her father was the richest man in the state. Her mother was a beautiful and admired woman. It was farm life, but it looked lavish and loving to outsiders. She had three sisters, and she knew that if she were lucky, she too would get her first car before even turning 13 years old. But turning 10, things changed. For years, Tina's family had been rocked by alcohol and her father's constant womanizing, and who could blame Tina for being scared of who she was? She writes that her older sisters were beauty queens and majorettes, but she knew deep down she didn't want to become a majorette like they were. She wanted to marry one. This was the 1950s into the 1960s, and when Tina turned 10, her mother walked out, couldn't take it anymore, and that left Tina in the care of her African-American nanny named Virgie, who had 9 children of her own. Virgie was a remarkable woman herself, and while she essentially became a surrogate mother for Tina, she was not allowed to eat from the family's plate or use their bathroom. But Virgie loved Tina, who grew to find the courage to embrace her own identity, eventually stood up to her father, and returned to the idea of her mother's love. Now, is that enough for a story for you? Amazingly, it's hardly the start for Tina Clark. She became a powerful voice in the music world, and she did it at a time when women were not often considered capable of doing most of the jobs. Yes, at the time, women could sing, they could write songs, maybe they would be backup singers, but producing was a man's job. Running a music label was a man's job. Tina wasn't interested in being defined by those rules. She wrote music, she produced it, she launched a label, and her career took her into the studio and homes of superstars. She won a Grammy for her work with Natalie Cole. She was nominated for a Grammy with her work with Patti LaBelle. She worked with Leanne Rimes, Maya Angelou, even Hillary Clinton. And so, Forbes has called Tina the female CEO who could sell fire to the devil. The woman who can do just about anything. And now, she is coming to Rochester to join the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. 2020 also marks suffragist Susan B. Anthony's 200th birthday and the 75th anniversary of the museum here. And so, Tina Clark is our guest here on the line with us. She's a music producer, author, civil rights activist, and it's awesome to have you on the line. Tina, how are you?
I am great. Thank you. Wow. I don't know how to follow that.
No, I said this to, and I'll say this to Deborah Hughes, and I'll say this to the audience. This time is going to go very quickly, and I'm a little overwhelmed just with the breadth of Tina's career and her life story here. And Deborah Hughes and I were talking before the hour began, Southern Discomfort, the memoir, doesn't necessarily even give you everything about the music career. I mean, like, there's so much to it. Hi, Deborah, by the way. Nice to have you in studio with us.
And hi, Tina.
Deborah's the executive director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House. It's a massive year with all of these anniversaries, 200 for the birthday, 100 for suffrage, 75 for the museum. And Tina's going to be here 2 Wednesdays, but it's not a luncheon this year.
Correct. It's a dinner. We had to do something big for Susan B. Anthony's 200th birthday. So it's a dinner. Right now we have about 1,000 people registered, but people can still get tickets at susanb.org. And what a year to have you, Tina, as our speaker, because there's so many ways that you represent both what Susan B. Anthony was working for, what she had as her hope for women. And so you kind of address a lot of the different angles. We're thrilled.
Well, thank you, Deborah. I mean, I'm just, I can't tell you how honored I am to be coming and having this opportunity to just see it, feel it, experience it, and just to be a big part, or be a part of this big celebration. I've been, you know, really choked up by the whole thing because I've just, it's amazing. And I will have to say, it is definitely a highlight to me in my life. So I am honored that you guys thought about me and asked me, and I'm really excited.
Tina, you know, growing up in the Deep South, at a time of civil rights struggles, at a time with you exploring and discovering your own sexuality and understanding some of the challenges and limitations you might have faced personally and later facing the limitations of what the music industry would assume is possible for women, I am curious to know, if you remember the first time you thought about Susan B. Anthony and maybe, you know, the context of a woman like that.
Well, obviously they were in my little mind and growing up in this little tiny rural town in Mississippi. I mean, they were few and far between. And obviously in school and in education, you know, of course I knew who Susan B. Anthony was. And but I just, to me, that was, it seemed like such a far reach to ever to me to make even a tiny speck of the kind of impact and change that she did, and especially at that time in the Deep South in Mississippi. And look, I'm not beginning to say I've made more than a speck, but I have sure spent a big portion of my life trying to make a difference and trying to be authentic to who I was, and you know, not taking no. I've always said that, you know, someone saying no to me because I'm a woman or really know about anything is like just waving a red flag in front of a bull. But a really good friend of mine said to me, just remember, she was talking about herself, and she said, I eat no for breakfast. And that kind of, that line kind of really resonated with me. It's just to aspire to even the thought process that Susan B. Anthony had and what she brought to us as women, but also to a nation and this world. You know, if you think about it simplistically, from a child's standpoint, of course, when you're little, I mean, you haven't learned, you were not born with bigotry. You were not born with inequality in your head, and you were not born with hate. Those are things that are taught and obviously acquired, and to some folks, you know, maybe stuffed down their little tiny throats at the time. But I just feel like if you just take that, and to me, that's who, in my mind, and what I know about her from all I have read, that's who Susan was, just organically. And I feel like that's who I've always been organically. I, you know, especially when knowing her work on anti-slavery and knowing just how I felt from the day that I could remember that, you know, what was going on here? This, they're, you know, them and us, so to speak. There's not that. We're all the same. I don't know how I had that organically inside of me, or did not let that light or that flame get snuffed out by what all was around during that civil rights era in Mississippi. But it did not go out, and it never did burn out, and it's not out now. So, you know, I just think there's there's just something inside of us all that we're born with, and we either choose to, not to be simplistic, but let it shine, or we allow someone to snuff it out. And she was not about to let someone snuff it out.
Well, and so having read interviews that you've done in various publications, there are two consistent themes that I see you refer to, which is, first of all, as you say, the idea of sort of eating no for breakfast, but also this idea that to challenge yourself and to become better, whether it's you're thinking about your kids or yourself, you always like to be with people who are better than you, or learning from people who are the best at what they do. The last thing you want to do is you know, put a kid in a basketball game if you want him to be a good basketball player with a bunch of people who are lesser talents if you want them to improve. And you were always that way when it comes to the music business. Let me ask you about your mentality that you started to gain when you knew you were going to end up in the music business. You have said that, you know, you love to write songs, but the producer has a big hand in how a songwriter's piece of work is going to be created. So you became a producer. But then you realize the label's got a lot of control over what happens with that. So you're going to you're going to create a label, but you are doing this all of this at a time when the music industry was essentially saying, no, those are men's jobs. How did you sort of navigate that?
Well, I just, you know, it was interesting because I just was doing, once again, what comes natural. And, you know, to be honest with you, it's not much has changed. And I know that may be hard to believe, but I'm on the Annenberg Inclusion Board and study that's being done through film and television and the music industry. And you may have seen some of those papers and reports, but it's directed by Dr. Stacy Smith with USC. And if you'll look at those and read any of those studies, you'll see that not a whole lot is different. But anyway, back to asking me how I navigated that. This is something interesting. When I first moved to LA under the wings of Hal David and Burt Bacharach, but Hal David, and I was writing for a lot of film and television at that time. When I would produce, because I always, whatever I'd write, I'd produce it. And I never thought twice about it. No one in film or television ever asked me, who produced this song? Oh, we need a guy to produce this. I was lucky enough to, maybe at the time of whoever I was working with, they were just like, oh, this is great. I love this, blah, blah, blah. Well, when I started really pursuing my career in the record business, that side of it, that was the first thing that was asked was, oh, we love the song. Someone, an A&R person label would say, oh, we love the song. Who did the demo? And I would say, well, I did. Oh, well, we've got a guy that's going to produce it, but I really like that demo. And I would hear producers take my songs and produce it exactly the same, that one or two things would happen. They would produce it exactly what I had on that demo, but I didn't get paid for producing it. Or they would just, you know, destroy it or ruin it from, you know. But it was really different, and it still is, you know. There's very, very few female producers.
Well, so your career, as I mentioned at the outset, has taken you into the studio with Natalie Cole, for which you won a Grammy, Patti LaBelle, Leanne Rimes. I mean, it is an amazing list that, you know, really is probably worth its own separate book and its own hour of conversation. Briefly, though, on this idea of making your own breaks. You know, I know your dad was in Vegas a lot, and you said he was sort of a big gambler, and he would take you with him. Uh-huh. But then put you with a babysitter because, you know, you couldn't go to the casinos. And so you end up, you want to see Nancy Sinatra, Hal Blaine's doing the drumming, and your dad lets you go. And you end up meeting Hal, and who, by the way, I guess asked your dad if he could take you for breakfast because he couldn't believe that this girl from Mississippi, like, that actually happened?
Yeah, it actually happened. And let me go back one second to, let's don't forget Aretha Franklin, the queen. So, you know, she was someone that I had worked with a lot and absolutely loved her. But now, you also said that warrants another book. I have to say that is my next book.
Okay.
Oh, good. Good.
And I've already started working on it because when I first, you know, when Simon & Schuster was first going to publish my memoir, you know, it was like talked about, oh, well, should we add the music career in here or not? And I just felt like it was too separate. I tried at first because they wanted me to try it, but it was literally like, you know, it would just jerk you out of the moment because even though they're happening at the same time, it's really this Southern Discomfort is a coming of age book. So anyway, long story short, that's going to be another book. So Nancy Sinatra, yes, that actually happened. So my dad would always take me with him, and he would take me to the you know, the shows, because that's the only thing I could really do there, is, you know, because he was gambling the other time. Mm-hmm. So we would go to shows, walk into the door, and obviously my dad would, not obviously, but my dad would pull out a wad of bills out of his pocket, hand it to the maitre d', and we would be next to the stage in the front. And so my dad knew that my idol, Hal Blaine, the drummer, that I'd wanted to see, I'd listened to everything he played, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So after the show, I was begging my dad, can I just go stand at the backstage door, at the stage door? Can I just go stand in case I can meet him? And my dad was like, yeah, I'm going to be over at the back rack table. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I was like, I don't know, 11, 12. And so I stood, you know, these days you wouldn't let your child go run off in a casino by herself. But back then it seemed different. So I stood at the backstage, stood there forever. Finally, he walks out. And when he walks out, I said, Mr. Blaine, I said, I am, you know, as most people do, you go, yeah, I'm your biggest fan. And he goes, really? And I said, yeah, I am the best drummer in Mississippi. And he goes, well, that's quite something. And I said, yes, and I wanted to talk to you, and I want you to tell me some things to study and what to da-da-da-da-da, because I want to be you one day.
How old were you?
I was 11 or 12. and he said, young lady, he said, where are your parents? And I said, well, I'm just here with my dad, and he's playing baccarat. And he said, well, let's walk over there with him. He said, how about I take you to breakfast in the morning? And your dad can come too. And I said, oh, wow, yes, yes. And so we go over. I call my dad over, and he said, you know, tells him he met me, and he would love to take me to breakfast if that was okay with him, and he was welcome to join. And my dad said, of course. My dad didn't join because he was too busy playing whatever he was playing the next morning. But that's how our long relationship over the years started. That's how it started. And I have so many letters from growing up of letters that he would send me and tell me what to listen to, tell me what to practice on. And then when I was about 14, he asked me, would my dad let me come out to L.A. and stay with he and his wife, and he could take me to the studio. Well, I did. And I would ride on the back of his, I think it was a Harley at that time. You got to realize, I was going to the studio with the Wrecking Crew. I had no idea what the impact of the Wrecking Crew was. And the way he introduced me, we walk into the studio, and he says, hey, boys, this is the best damn drummer in Mississippi.
That's such a remarkable story. Got a little bit of time left with Tina Clark, who's our guest here. And once again, Deborah Hughes from the Susan B. Anthony House and Museum. Remind people how they can get tickets if they want to come hear Tina's, an extended Tina Clark in person in Rochester, two Wednesday nights from now.
Our website, susanb.org, or 279-7490 if they want to call.
SusanB.org if you want tickets. And you said there's already about 1,000 who've registered.
There are.
But there is still space if you want it.
There is. There's a good chance we're going to sell out.
There's a chance. Well, it often happens during this program, by the way, when we're talking to the guest and the keynote speaker, Tina Clark, who, as we said at the outset, may not be a household name, but you've no doubt heard her music. And in a moment, you're going to hear some of the music, because I've got some pulled up for you. And I will also say that there are stories, you know, Tina, the Stevie Wonder story. There's so many stories that I probably can't even get to in the limited time here. Is there one single story beyond the one you just shared with us from your time in the music world that for you is sort of indicative of either the success that you've made despite some of the odds that you've faced as a woman, or kind of that kind of attest to your views on kind of kicking doors open when they seem to be locked?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is relatable to, obviously, what we're all going to be gathering together for is, you know, from the standpoint of women helping women. I say that the, and I talked about this a lot, that I don't know if I would have ever been recognized and as a producer and given the shot to produce in the record business if it had not been for a female artist. There was an artist that was on A&M, and she was a new artist, and her name was Vesta, and she's passed away now at an early age. But we had worked together a lot. I had used her as a singer in television and film and commercials that I had done, and she was a phenomenal, phenomenal singer. And so when she got a record deal, she called me up and said, I would really like for you to write and produce some of the songs on my record. And I was like, I laughed and I said, well, I would of course I'll write songs for you. I said, but they'll never let me produce. And she was like, why? And I said, they do not let women produce. And she goes, well, you're going to produce on my record. And I said, you can't do that. I said, because, you know, you're not a known entity, you're new, and you don't want to mess with your career. I said, you really don't want to hurt your career. Don't die on that sword right now. You can wait a while. I am so privileged and that you've even asked me. I said, but don't rock that boat. She came back to me and said, you know what? I've decided I'll just have laryngitis until they say that you can write, that you can produce.
Wow.
And I said, you can't do that. Well, she did. So she told the record label that she wanted me to produce, and they said no, they had this guy that was going to produce her. She said, well, then I'll have laryngitis until you decide that I can have this person I want, because I know that she can write and produce a hit on me. And I was just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe she did it. In fact, you know, I encouraged her not to do it. They thought she was kind of, they didn't really believe that she would do that. 4 weeks passed by, they can't get her to come in the studio. And they finally, the guy says, which, you know, as a woman, we've all heard this before, you know, but he says, he said to her, okay, look, whoever this Tina Clark person is, you just go produce a few tracks and then we'll do the record. Basically what he was saying is, you little girls go off and play some, then come back, then we'll do the real record. That's what he was saying. Well, our heads were on the chopping block. I knew that if I was ever going to break out and break through as a producer, this was it.
Yep.
And from that, she and I wrote together, and I produced on her a number one hit. It was her signature song throughout her career. It was called Congratulations. And the rest was kind of history. From all of a sudden, it was like this, overnight, all of a sudden, guess what? I'm a producer. I'd always been a producer, but it was because of her taking that shot on me. And you know, when she passed away, not to digress here, but it was really special when she passed away. Her family had asked me to give the eulogy in L.A. And I don't know that a lot of people knew what she had done, you know, so it was, that was a breakthrough moment.
Mm. Well, but it strikes me though, Tina, that, you know, your success in that moment, that was a hinge point in your life and in your career, and you nailed it. And then they went, oh, okay, yeah, this woman can actually do it. So we'll let the door stay open. The implication, of course, is that if it hadn't gone well, that could have really been the permanent closing of a lot of doors. And it strikes me that we will have a truly more equal society when, whether it's women in producing or women directing movies, when we've got films like Black Panther, and what did everybody hear about, you know, Girls Trip or Black Panther? Well, you know, if it does well at the box office, maybe these studios will take a chance on, you know, more black-centered films. But if it doesn't, boy, I don't know if they'll do it again. Like, there's one chance, whereas, you know, Michael Bay could make 10 lemons, and Michael Bay is going to get the next job. There's no worry about that. And, you know, so I think your story is amazing, but I also think it does still talk to the double standard, if that makes sense.
Of course, and I think it's the same way, not to jump tracks and go over to another subject, but I think it's the same thing with, you know, if you're gay, it's like, well, if you're going to get married, you know, you better stay married. You can't have any issues here because we're going to give you one shot, you know, to, I don't know if I'm making sense of what I'm saying, but it's like, it's like society in the beginning when first gay rights, you know, as far as gay marriage, was on the forefront. It was like, nobody ever thought about divorce because, you know, it was basically like, okay, we're going to be okay with this and let you get married one time. But then, you know, if you mess up,
you better handle this because we heterosexuals never have a problem with marriage.
Yeah, we never have a problem with marriage, and we're the only ones who get a divorce. So don't ever even think about it.
Oh, boy. I mean, and listeners, by the way, the memoir touches on, as you might expect, Tina's own exploration of sexuality, understanding herself, what it was like to date in high school at a time where you could kind of get away with, you know, being, as she says very directly in the book, you're just a prude teenager, you know, that's all. But again, you know, how difficult that must be. And it's a whole separate story. But before we lose the time with Tina, I'd like to listen to a little bit of music. And this is a track that has now been listened to and performed. Well, it's been listened to millions upon millions of times, but it's one of the most performed tracks of music. And if you haven't heard it, it's because it's now 6-7 years old. But when I read the lyrics to you, and I'm going to read some of the lyrics now, you might think that this would have been written in the Me Too era. It was a track written for 1 Billion Rising. It's Break the Chain. And I'm going to go ahead and read some of the lyrics, and we're going to listen. Because think about this. This sounds like a Me Too song. I can see a world where we all live, safe and free from oppression. No more rape or incest, abuse. Women are not a possession. You've never owned me, don't even know me. I'm not invisible. I'm simply wonderful. I feel my heart for the first time racing. I feel alive. I feel so amazing. This is part of Break the Chain. And I think this hit dropped in late 2012, but it really feels like a track for even the Me Too era. You want to tell us a little bit more about that, Tina?
Well, it's still going strong now, you know, because every year there, you know, women on around February the 14th, because that's when Eve Ensler, who was the founder of and who is still her life's work of, you know, 1 Billion Rising to stop violence against women globally. Women, if you know, just all over the world in over 200 countries come out in force on that day or around that day and dance and sing this song. And it's been really one of the most amazing things I've ever been asked to do and been involved in. And every year, just to see these hundreds and hundreds and now thousands and thousands of videos that are uploaded to 1 Billion Rising site of women all over the world. I mean, it can be 10 women in Nigeria. It can be, you know, 10,000 in the Philippines. It's every country. And it's just to see that these women and young girls and then also young men, and in a lot of cases, you know, it's just huge, huge, outpouring of people coming now, and it's an annual thing. So yeah, when Eve had asked me to write this, I've always been involved in, been so part of my passion is not only to stop you know, domestic violence, but violence everywhere against women and girls. And so I just feel like, and that's kind of where my, not kind of, it is where my head is these days, that, and has been for probably the past 10 years, is I really only want to write, use this gift to write music and lyrics about things that will help people understand issues, or maybe to make them think about the issue, mm-hmm. or change, or take, or to take action on it. And it's just, it's been, I've been very fulfilled.
Break the Chain is the song we're referring to here. And before I let you go, one more question that I'm going to apologize.
Sure.
I'm going to apologize in advance here, because I know. Uh-oh. I'm gonna sort of piggyback on something that you say that you have been asked so many times by so many music journalists over the years, but I want to try to put a new spin on it. All right. So here's the question you get all the time that you sort of get tired of, which is, how did this white girl from Mississippi end up writing and producing R&B music? So, you know, you've joked that, well, you would often respond, "What did you think? I'm just supposed to write country because I'm from Mississippi," and you add that R&B songwriters never die; they just become country writers, which I think is hilarious.
Correct.
But what I want to ask you then, the follow up I have is, and I'm trying to be sensitive with this question. I do understand some of the debates in sort of the modern culture about who is writing for whom. Who is performing what kind of music? I mean, I sort of wonder if Elvis came along now, if his career would be different because of views of things like appropriation. But I think your story, given your life, given everything from your relationship with Virgie to the way that Stevie Wonder came into your life, to all the people you've worked with from all these different backgrounds, it says to me that if I just looked at Tina Clark as this white woman and I said, well, she shouldn't be doing R&B, that I should be careful not to judge without really knowing someone's story. That's one of the things I think I'm learning from your story. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's 100%. And I mean, I always say that, you know, when I first would sit down to write, I didn't, and still today, I don't think, oh, I'm going to write an R&B song. Oh, I'm going to write a country song. When I started writing, and through my early years and on, whatever came out of my hands and my head and my heart, I mean, not to sound cliche, but your soul doesn't have a color. And it's what just came out. And I think a lot of it, I'm sure I was influenced by growing up with my mom. You know, my mom was a songwriter in the big band era, and just, you know, listened to music all the time. And always on her turntable was, you know, Billie Holiday, you know, Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, on and on and on. And that's what she listened to, and that's what I grew up listening to. And then you take Virgie listened to gospel and just really down-home gospel. And then Beulah May, that I talk about, who was her best friend, you know, she was a honky-tonk girl. So she was a juke joint girl. And so it was a lot of blues and really kind of, you know, at that time, you know, it was everything from the Staple Singers to B.B. King, et cetera. And so I just, that's what I grew up on. And I'm sure that's where a lot of my influence came. It also came from, I think, the just agonizing that I had in my heart and in my life of what I was seeing going on around me.
Tina, congratulations on your remarkable career, and I know Susan B. Anthony Museum and House is excited to have you. I'll be there two Wednesday nights from now, and I'm looking forward to shaking your hand in person, but it's been an honor, and thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you, and I hope that I can make Susan B. Anthony and the Susan B. Anthony organization and museum proud Believe me, I'm a little, I never get nervous. I'm a little nervous, I have to be honest with you. But thanks, Deborah.
You're welcome, Tina.
Thank you, Tina. Tina, the CEO, Chief Creative Officer for DMI Music and Media Solutions, and her work, of course. Even if you don't know the name, you've heard it in a lot of different places, and she'll be here. So let's get our only break of the hour. And Deborah, let's talk a little bit more about what's coming up in a couple of Wednesdays from now on this historic year, 200 years since the birth of Susan B. Anthony, 100 years since suffrage, and 75 years for the Museum and House. Let's continue in just a moment on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli about his office's ongoing audit of the Rochester City School District. He'll tell us about what the goals of the audit are and where things stand with that audit. And then you will hear from members of the Rochester City School Board. There have been some disagreements about the state of finances. They'll have a chance to respond to the comptroller live next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hey, we should mention as we move on here from Tina Clark that she also, you know, won a Grammy. She did work with Natalie Cole, and I think we've got "Walking My Baby Back Home," don't we? This is one that she produced from the album "Still Unforgettable" that won a Grammy. This is Tina's work producing this. Let's listen.
Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home.
We go along harmonizing a song, I'm reciting a poem. Hours go by and they give me the eye, walking my baby back home.
That's just one of the examples of Tina Clark's career. When I go down, Deborah, her list of work, I'm going, oh, I knew that one. I know that one. She's one of those who his name has been in the background of the music industry, if not at the forefront, but we've heard the work.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I know a couple people have said, you know, who's the big name for 2020? And it's because this is 2020 that we were able to get Tina to come. And it's her career is remarkable. She's remarkable.
Yeah, there's no question when you see a resume like that, that stands alone. And most of our conversation was about that resume. But the memoir, I should say, is absolutely worth picking up. The book is called Southern Discomfort. And I think I was a little surprised that it is. I mean, it's essentially it's her personal life. It's not her amazing music career. I'm not surprised to hear the publisher wants one on the music career. What did you get from this memoir?
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit like what you're talking about, R&B, there's something about the way Tina writes and produces where she captures truth. She tells stories that you do say, what? Is that true? Is that a true story? And she has that ability to really engage you where all the emotions come in without her manipulating your emotions. And then she puts, there's hope. I think that's that amazing piece. There's that balance of, wow, there's reality, even more real than I could have imagined it. And yet somehow you don't leave this book, which is about one of the most dysfunctional families I've ever read about.
Yeah.
And somehow I left feeling uplifted at the end of the book.
Well, I'm going to read a little passage because there's a passage here that reminded me of Edie Windsor's book. We had Edie Windsor on the program recently, of course. I'm sorry, we had Edie Windsor's spouse, the late Edie Windsor. She passed away in the last couple of years, LGBTQ rights icon, this amazing life, and her surviving spouse, it was on the program with us. She was in Rochester, and you know, we read Edie's book, and producer Megan Mack and I both agreed that, you know, that reads a lot like this one, that it's this really accessible, personal, sometimes painful story of someone's coming of age and then the work that they were doing. And so here's a passage that I was alluding to in the interview about her own sexuality. And I'm going to read from this because I think it's important for us to continue to ask questions about what we are doing to kids with their own identities and what when we allow someone to feel like they can be themselves as opposed to how do I figure out a way to eventually live as myself. Here's what she writes, knowing that, you know, she knew that she was gay, but she it was hard. I mean, she's grown up in the Deep South in the 50s and 60s, and she writes the following quote, "When my own cousin Bubba told me in confidence that he was gay, I stood there in shock, my mouth hanging open so long I could have caught flies. But it wasn't the surprise of his being gay. I had known for years he had no interest in girls. My shock was that he would say that word out loud, in Waynesboro, no less. And I also feared he would then ask me, straight up, well, you are too, right? Yes, I had feelings for girls, but I didn't want anyone else to know. Not here, not now. I figured if I could ignore those feelings, then no one else would have to know either, and I could quietly escape and then figure it out later, far, far from Waynesboro," end quote. How many people's story is that right there? Isn't that unfortunately something close to universal for people who grew up in that time who were not straight?
Well, it's still true for people who grew up in a lot of places. You know, Rochester's a pretty amazing, affirming community, and yet you still have preteens and teenagers who tell you the same experience, that they don't feel safe with their own family or friends, even if their family and friends actually would be accepting, that they still have internalized enough homophobia that they're afraid that somehow that will separate them. But you go a few miles off of I-90 and there are kids who feel much more isolated. And they come to Rochester, the big city, to find freedom.
That's another interesting point that we had talked about in that conversation, because it's like there is this sort of sliding scale, unfortunately, of acceptance that, and this is a big generalization, but rural to urban, sometimes north to south. And again, there's all kinds of exceptions, and I'm aware of that. But the reason I wanted to read that passage was that's the 1960s. How far have we come? And the answer that I think I'm hearing from you, Deborah, is not far enough, because yes, it's more comfortable now to be a gay teenager. I don't know about trans. I mean, I don't know about, you know, and I shouldn't just assume, well, it's easy to be a gay teenager. I mean, there's different levels of challenge. And Tina's book, I think, just still puts that in stark relief to, you know, my own experience where, you know, straight kids don't grow up and wonder, can I be me? We don't. That's sort of the privilege of not having to worry about that. What do we need to do to maybe continue to knock down those barriers?
Well, I think when you were talking, I was thinking about a speech from Susan B. Anthony near the end of the 19th century, and she faced a lot of gender bias discrimination. Mm-hmm. They would discredit her any way they could. So one of the things was to say that Susan B. Anthony was a manly woman. And she turns that around and she gives this fabulous speech as she's looking toward the 20th century about when we'll be a world full of manly women and womanly men, and that when we get to that point where everybody can truly be who they are, we will really be able to have a society that thrives and utilizes all those gifts. And I think that's the piece for any child to get to the place where they feel they can really be who they are. I don't know how we get that society. Unfortunately, one of the bad sides of human nature is that we're threatened by something different.
Well, so the idea that Susan B. would be described in a pejorative sense as a manly man, I'm thinking out loud here, and producer Megan Mack, maybe for us this is a conversation for the show next week, because there's a clip going viral of Sarah Spain from ESPN. She had some words for anyone who thinks women are soft. There's a basketball player for the Boston Celtics, Marcus Morris. Actually, no, he's with New York now. And he got into an on-court altercation with another player, Jay Crowder. And Marcus Morris tells reporters after the game, he's soft, he plays like a woman, he has a lot of women-like tendencies on the court, and he's just tired of playing with players who are soft and woman-like. And Sarah Spain for ESPN basically said, it's 2020. This is enough. What are we doing with this? Maybe that's a whole other conversation we ought to have in the program recently, because that rhetoric still happens. But it's interesting to me to hear the history that Susan B. was sort of tried to be tarred as, well, you're a man-like woman, as if that's some kind of a put-down. Well, we're still doing that.
It was actually a reason to be put in jail in the 19th century.
You want to elaborate on that?
Well, Rochester had on its books, if you were to dress outside of your gender, it was a $1,000 fine and up to a year in jail if you went out in public as a woman dressing like a man or a man dressing like a woman.
Why are we so threatened, Deborah? Why are we still so threatened?
Well, I think that's one of the pieces. Clearly, we're still threatened about what would happen if people cross out of those lines. And what is that about? Is it that we're so insecure that we actually think if we let everybody in, we can't compete? And I think there is a layer of that. It's the if you have somebody like Tina Clark, who's this brilliant producer, well, if I were an insecure person in the field, I might be threatened by her. And let's just keep anybody out who might excel. Unfortunately, that's part of the dynamic.
Do you have a sense for what she's going to talk about two Wednesdays from now?
I don't. I'm very excited.
Isn't that exciting?
I can't wait.
She could literally just talk about her life. She could talk about her career. Pretty much anything. Tina Clark will be here two Wednesdays from now. And as we're moving really now, we're almost done with January through 2020. You know, there's been a lot of build up to this year because of, you know, sort of the round number anniversaries here. What's the most important part of this year and what you want the public to be thinking about, Deborah?
Well, it's an incredible year of celebration, as you've said. It's both really being grateful for the pioneers, women and men, who've gotten us this far. And it's also the challenge to say, okay, this is Susan B. Anthony's entering into her third century. Not a lot of brands or people have that much longevity and that much relevance. And she's as relevant today. She's more relevant than she was 10 years ago in some ways because of where we are. So to me, as we look at the history, look honestly at the history, look at the context, look at where we are now, the real question is, what do we need to do so that 20 years from now we can say, look how much farther we've come, so that at the end of another century people will say, boy, back in the old days, people couldn't be who they were. That must have been really hard, really, really difficult. To me, that's the piece. At the core of who people like Susan B. Anthony, Frederick Douglass were, was this vision that we actually are all created in some kind of image, and we'd be a better society when we started gently treating one another with kindness and support, challenging directly the structural barriers that get in the way, and trying to figure out how to be a better society.
Can you contextualize as best you can, without speaking for Susan B. Anthony, of course, but the current moment that feels as polarized as it does culturally, politically? We have this sort of way of being a little myopic and thinking, well, this is the worst it's ever been, or this is the most polarized it's ever been. And there's a bit of an availability bias there. You know, we weren't there 100 years ago. We weren't there 150 years ago. We weren't there 130 years ago when some of the suffrage battles were happening, for example. But at the end of Susan B. Anthony's life, how polarized do you think the society was versus how it feels today? Is there a way to contextualize that?
I think the polarization is complicated. When you asked about polarization, I immediately thought to the Civil War. You know, Susan B. Anthony lived through the Civil War, and we certainly were never more polarized. But the interesting thing is we don't even agree yet on what we were polarized about. For Susan B. Anthony at the Women's Loyalty League, she was really saying, this is the moment we absolutely have to end this institution of slavery. And other people were saying, well, no, we just kind of have to stop having brothers fight against brothers. Some people were even then saying, well, this is about economy or state rights versus national rights. So even when we talk about where are we polarized, mm-hmm. we're not even in agreement about where we're divided. Susan B. Anthony saw that, and I think the biggest core issue in the 19th century as now, or the biggest issue coming out of the Civil War, was, is the purpose of government, of a national government, to bring people together and to serve the people, all the people? Or is the purpose to have particular parties have their moments in time when they serve their constituents? I think that's where we're polarized right now. Is the point of government to serve not the people who won the last election? I'm amused by the notion, gee, I could just not pay my taxes every time my party doesn't win, because if that government's not serving my agenda, why should I participate? The government's supposed to serve all of us once people are elected. Mm-hmm. And Susan B. Anthony saw effective government, and she saw some of the most horrific problems in Congress and in the United States. And we somehow romanticize the past, but we're still in that same reality. We're really at our very core trying to say, what's good government? What's its aim? What's its purpose? How do we participate in that?
Again, it's susanb.org. For tickets, for information on the celebration, again, it's usually a luncheon, it's a dinner, and I'll be there this year. Would love to see you there. Tina Clark will be speaking two Wednesdays from now, and that's the 12th.
The 12th. Okay. And we had a dinner so you could come, Evan, since 1370 Connections is yes. always at lunch.
Yes. I get to be there this year, which is exciting. But 30 seconds, what else is happening at the museum and house that you're excited about?
We're really excited about Votercade coming up this summer, where we'll be going across the Finger Lakes and having a series of wonderful intergenerational outdoor programs for people to think about civic discourse and voting suppression and voting rights. We're thrilled about things that like the RPO is doing, WXXI. So many of our arts and cultural organizations here in Rochester and in the Finger Lakes are celebrating these significant anniversaries, and we're so excited about that.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
As always, the executive director of the Susan B. Anthony Museum and House is Deborah Hughes. You heard Tina Clark, a music producer, author, and civil rights activist, on the line with us earlier this hour, and she is bringing her story to Rochester. Big, big name in the music industry, and she'll be here for the celebration. SusanB.org. Coming up next, New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli joins us talking about his office's ongoing audit of the Rochester City School District. That's next on Connections.